So what I would suggest is we'll go right into the next session, and it'll be, as I said, a collaboration between three of us to bring some points across. If I could ask Alasdair Kent from the Genetic Alliance UK and Isabelle Moulon from the European Medicines Agency on stage, and then I'll introduce the topic in a second when we have the colleagues here. Great to see you. Very well. So we call it a 360 perspective on innovative ways of patient involvement in medicines development. This could mean a lot of things, but it was important to us now to broaden the circle again, to have two colleagues who, again, have been so passionate about patient involvement. I think all of you know Isabelle, what she's done at EMA over the years, how systematic this is now, how patient input really is an SOP almost, if you like. And Alasdair Kent, who's dedicated many, many years of his life to advance science, to represent patients, and to really make a difference for the community on behalf of the Genetic Alliance UK, but also really being in many bodies, advisory committees, whether it's regulators, whether it's HTAs or industry. I really look forward to this session. And what we thought is we'll ask Alasdair to kick it off with some of his thoughts. Then I'll go next, and then Isabelle, and then we'll have room for Q&A and for discussion. Please, Alasdair.
Thank you. Well, good morning, everybody, and I'm delighted to be here. I'm tempted just to stand up and say, well, I agree with Eric and sit down because, you know, he talks such an awful lot of common sense and you know, you couldn't but agree with him. But I suspect that Tony might have a few words with me about that if I were simply to do that. So looking at the 360-degree view of patient involvement in medicine development, I think it's important when you think about why we need medicines, where they come from, who makes them, who's involved, to remember that the patient is the only involuntary partner in this process. You know, everybody else has a choice. We don't have a choice. Surprisingly enough, patients were not put on this earth to give scientists and clinicians and industry something interesting to do. We have an unmet health need, and the only way in which we can escape from the impact of that unmet health need is by engaging in high-quality biomedical research and development and seeing the outputs from that research translated into effective, available, sustainable, affordable interventions that address real health needs. And that's where the patient perspective, the patient input, I think, is fundamental. Because I want to say right from the start, you know, as patients, we have absolutely no interest in drugs that don't work. You know, other parts of the health service seem quite keen on investing in things that don't work. There was a report just before Christmas from the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, which listed 40 things in common use in the NHS today that have no clinical benefit, but we keep on using them. You'd think we might stop and use that money for other things that might have a benefit. And it's important to involve patients in this process because we think it's a good idea that you do on account of the unique insights that we can bring to the situation in which we find ourselves. This is especially the case with rare diseases, but it's not confined to rare diseases. With rare diseases, they're often poorly characterized. The natural history isn't clear. It's not easy when you're developing a therapy to measure the impact of that therapy if the disease that you're studying is not in itself well known and well understood. So patient insights into what life with a disease is like can help you identify common features of the condition and think about how you might address them. But also, involvement of patients in the process right from the start helps you to identify those things that really matter and which, if the research, the development is successful, will help you to develop a therapy that is likely to be able to get through the licensing process and post-licensing through HTA and reimbursement systems in order to finally get to the patient. Because, I mean, it's obvious, but the best therapy in the world is useless if it stays on the pharmacy shelf and doesn't actually make it to those for whom it has been developed. Now, it's sometimes not obvious what the important things about a disease are when you come at it from a patient perspective. If you take, for example, Alzheimer's disease, if you talk to patients and carers of people with Alzheimer's disease, what they will stress is the importance of preserving independence in daily living, the ability to look after yourself as well as you can for as long as you can. But unfortunately, much of the research into causes and potential therapies for Alzheimer's disease has focused on the preservation of intellectual capacity. Now, intellectual capacity is relatively straightforward to measure, whereas independence in daily living is much more challenging. But arguably, if you don't do something about preserving independence in daily living, but preserve the intellectual capacity of those people who are declining through the progression of the disease, you're not doing them any favours. You're simply preserving their awareness of what they're losing and the growing potential indignity of their situation for longer. So, you know, maybe you need to think about how help engaging with patients can help you select your targets. Similarly, with Parkinson's disease, you know, the thing that Parkinson's patients report as being the absolute aspect of that condition that gets them down is the bone-numbing tiredness, the fatigue that besets their lives. Yet most of the research has focused on measuring muscle, the involuntary muscle spasms, and seeing if they're affected. Yes, they're bad. You don't want them. But they're easier to cope with if you've got a bit of energy to get through your day. So, you know, think about asking the patients what matters to them, what aspects of those conditions that they have. Yeah, they're a nuisance, but you can cope with them. And you would cope with them that much better if the primary debilitating features of the condition for you as the person with it were to be targeted. Focusing on patients too can give added dimensions to the value of the data that that you generate. Again, there was an experiment, a clinical trial a few years ago, it was Parkinson's patients again, which involved using fetal stem cells injected into the brain to look at whether it would control the muscle movements better. And the trial had to be stopped. Quite possibly the trial was premature in its in going into humans. I don't want to argue whether it was a good trial or a bad trial, but I do want to say that one of the patients who was on that trial, a very small trial, only about 10 patients, said, yep, it was stopped because in some of those, the involuntary muscle movements got worse. And the patient, one of the patients said, yeah, my muscle movements did get worse. But I could speak to my granddaughter for the first time in about 10 years. And I know which was more important to me. So, you know, this was not something which the protocol had thought as a possible endpoint. So speaking to the patients might help you broaden and change the focus of the endpoints. It can also help with the design of the trial and its implementation. A couple of years ago, we did a citizens' jury, which looked at the process by which innovative therapies for life-limiting conditions were brought to the medicines agency for consideration for a marketing authorization. Now, our jury, unlike most citizens' jury, was made up entirely of patients with or carers for people with life-limiting and, at that point, intractable, incurable conditions. And what our jurors said, and Paul, where are you? This was backed up by 600 patients across the whole of Europe in a subsequent survey, so take note. Our jurors said, look, yeah, of course we want you. We know hard endpoints are important. We know that you've got to do the biology. You've got to produce the evidence of that the medicine is bringing about the physiological change that you intend it to bring about. But that's not the end of the story. We want to see, we want to see a much greater recognition of the societal and the psychological impact of living with a life-limiting disease taken into account. You know, how our quality of life can be improved by feeling that we are engaged in the process of taking control of our disease rather than being controlled by it and driven along blindly. We want to have a say in the benefit-risk calculation. Some years ago, I was on the Orphan Medicinal Products Committee at the Medicines Agency as a patient member of that committee. And very often, there were three of us, three patient reps on that committee, and the rest of the committee was made up of members of national competent authorities, members from the Commission, and the Medicines Agency. And frequently, the traditional regulators would say, well, that's far too risky, far too risky. Patients would never stand for it. And time and again, we'd say, well, have you asked them? You know. And that usually was met with a sort of fairly deafening silence. I'm sure it's not the case now. I'm sure that they're much better educated then. But it was then it was quite a radical notion that you should ask patients about benefit and risk. And if you do ask patients about benefit and risk, you'll find that not all benefits are equally valued and not all risks are equally acceptable. For example, if you talk to families where you have a boy with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, then what they will say is that, yeah, going off your feet into a wheelchair is a massive step in the development of the condition. But there are alternatives. And for many boys, when they go off their feet, actually they become more independent and more able to do things because it's easier for them to get around in a wheelchair than it is in those final stages of ambulant mobility. What really matters is the ability to maintain the use of your hands for as long as possible, the flexibility, the muscle power. Because, you know, like most teenagers, they don't talk to you. They engage with you through their phones and their iPads and on Snapchat and Facebook and what have you. you know, so keeping the opportunity to keep muscle strength in your upper limbs is essential to maintain the quality of life for those deteriorating with Duchenne. But the recently licensed therapy, I haven't started on my slides yet. So no, I'm nearly there. I say the recently licensed therapy for Duchenne used the 6-minute walk test as an endpoint. There isn't a 6-minute hand test, but it would have been nice if that 6-minute function could in the upper limbs could have been measured, because that would have been more valuable to the patients, to the boys with the condition, and to their families, and might have helped in the next stage when it comes to convincing HTA bodies of the value of the change that the therapy brings about. The third point is in terms of trial design. You know, there is a much-used trope, nothing about us without us, which says if you ask us to fit our lives into your trial, we probably won't do as well as if you fit your trial around our lives, because that way you're more likely to get more rapid recruitment, greater compliance with the regime, and retention through to the end. So you'll get your data quicker and more reliably. And the final point there was that if you are setting up a trial, remember that the patient is not the only person affected by the trial. The trial affects the family. And particularly if you're talking about research with children, there may be other family members whose lives will be disrupted if mum or dad or both have to bring their sick child to a centre of excellence, which may be, you know, many miles away from the family home, and spend time in an unfamiliar environment whilst the rest of the family, their education may be disrupted, there may be other, you know, their social life is put on hold, and so on. So think about how you can support not just the patient going through the trial, but those around the patient whose engagement with the process is essential if you really want to do good quality research that will produce the results you need as quickly, to as high a quality and as efficiently as you can. So those seem to me some fairly cogent reasons why you should have a patient input, and I look forward to hearing what Tony and Isabel have to say on those thoughts.
Thank you, Alistair, and we'll take comments and questions in a second. I think what you introduced for the first time this morning is what's extremely important if we want to innovate, in inverted commas, but make progress is probably a better word. And that's, you know, what's the definition of patient, right? It's not just the one who suffers from the disease. It includes those who care for the disease, and most certainly those who live with the one who has the disease. And those could be distinctly different stakeholders that have different needs, which we need to consider. I wanted to offer you a couple of thoughts from an industry perspective. I think I showed you two fairly innovative things already in the dialogue with Eric. This is a very traditional one I'll start with. This is basically just a Gantt chart, right, that talks about the various steps in the development of a drug. There's nothing innovative there. And I think for many years we thought it's really innovative when we start including patients on this journey, right? Because, you know, you could say, well, historically we started a conversation in phase three. But I think what we tried to say before is this has to start very, very early on, right? If you want to discuss a development strategy, if you want to discuss an evidence generation plan or a target product profile validation. So this is this ongoing journey, I think, that will help us develop drugs much better and much more efficiently. And to the question we had before, I'm convinced if we have this multi-stakeholder input early on and continuously, there will also be a return on, if you want, the investment. But the drive is here really, as Alistair said so well, let's not design a trial and then drag the patients into the trial, but maybe we can do this together so that the endpoints, the design, make sense for all stakeholders. So again, while we can do innovative things in involving patients along this journey, I think the idea per se is perhaps not so novel. I brought you another slide, which we showed to the top 500 of our corporate management at one of our, the annual management team meeting 2 weeks ago. And the whole story here is exactly the same what I showed you before, right? This journey from very early on to really now launching, offering the product to patients through the life cycle, do we talk to each other? Do we consult each other? And that includes really every one of these milestones. But I would tell you, if you want to create true innovation and if you want to develop true partnerships, this goes certainly from my industry perspective way beyond the drug or the medicine itself. So one is this whole bigger area of research and development early on. You know, what are the true needs? There's no more point in developing a drug because I think I'm good in developing drugs. What are the true unmet needs, and do I have an opportunity to meet them? I can tell you, at Amgen, we do a lot of targeted genetics. We have major access to genetic capabilities, as you may know, Decode in Iceland. And so if I know there is a real need, to use this example before, in cardiovascular therapeutic areas such as lipid lowering, and I find a certain kind of gene that plays a role, I might be able to target just that because I have this information from patients. Then the other piece, we often forget, you know, here the second one on top is process development, right? Well, I might be able to offer you the drug as an infusion, which mandates you to come to the hospital twice a week. And the infusion time is, tell me something, 3 hours. That's a very different value proposition, I believe, for patients than, you know, when you tell me, well, you know, if I can have it subcutaneously and I can have it, I don't know, once a week or so. So sometimes, you know, we shoot to target really, really quickly, but maybe the formulation or many other things are not ideal and not informed well. And so I would submit to you there, too. It plays a big role. And then I already introduced the third one. I have, you know, I just listed a number of devices there. So one of the things, to give you an example, one of our drugs needs to be administered one day post-chemotherapy or post-treatment cycle in the hospital. And for many patients who live in remote areas, that's a big deal, right? Do you want to go back to that hospital? And they can't self, or they're not trained in self-injection yet because it's a one-time shot. So here is a device that you get put on in the hospital, and it will inject exactly a day later, and it will beep, and it will warn you, and then you can take it off. That's been a major thing, little things informed by true patient input. That makes a big difference in patients' lives, whether you go with your kid or yourself 100 kilometers to the hospital. And last but not least, when we talk about true innovation, I mentioned it before, I think what we can do already today with modern term variables, you know, old term kind of monitoring and all sorts of things, is just unbelievable. Let me show you a couple of things. What we've done is used more and more variable sensor technology to really get pretty much real-time, real-world data when patients are on drugs or even clinical trials or even are willing to contribute to a clinical trial and you need to have certain monitoring of vital signs or lab parameters before. You can do all this, actually, right now. In the patient setting, the patient doesn't need to come back to you. You can do this in a mobile way. Here is three examples, and I just picked them randomly, really. So here is one example in cardiovascular, which is, I call it a two-way engagement app, right? Maybe it's not the right word, but you know, it's visit reminders, it's calendars, it's two-way communication with whoever is responsible for the trial, maybe your physician, dose reminders, the whole thing. And as you know, you can put certain technology in your to-be-administered drug or whatever it is, and then your smartphone will know whether it was administered or not. And then, you know, there's another example in neuroscience, a kind of what I call a disease management app where, you know, it informs the patient and us how ready is the patient, does he have a certain set of symptoms or not, and kind of give that information. Then the whole biometrics piece is another example in cardiology. This is an interesting one. This is kind of where we've combined, it's kind of a pilot virtual study with an Apple Watch and an iPhone and real world data that we get here over a quite nice period actually, where, you know, there's some virtual screening. Patients can go to an app store. They can get the app. Then you get this Apple Watch, and then once it's activated, you track basically your disease, right? Your migraine, what's important for you, kind of what's the degree of suffering and the likes. Forget the small print on the right-hand side. But it's one of these examples, right? It's a tiny example. But what a difference, rather than going to the hospital every 2 days or every 3 days, or, you know, being monitored in different ways. Of course, this is a pilot, and we'll have to validate it and everything. But I just wanted to use this as another example where we can really make, I think, a big difference in developing drugs, getting real-world data directly from the patient. And he or she also has this data now, all of a sudden, and can say this is good or bad. And to Alistair's point, we have to make sure what we measure is meaningful, right? There's no point that I measure the pulse if it doesn't make a difference for the patient. But, you know, if you have huge suffering and you can capture that somehow and have an objective way of reporting that, that would be really good. So I think I used some examples here. And, you know, just from here, I truly believe we have so much opportunity to work with patients throughout the life cycle. I've given you some innovative examples from my perspective, at least. And I think, as Eric said and as Alistair said, we just have to listen more. And when we do that, I think we can build it in early enough so that the results, hopefully, will make a difference and will truly inform the regulators, the HTAs, and certainly the healthcare providers as well. So I'll pause here. And I'll turn it over to Isabel to give us her view. And I'll just give you the clicker. Here we go. And clean that for you. Here we go.
Thank you. Good morning. First of all, I would like to know how many patient or patient representative are in the room. Not a lot, so I assume that the rest of you are from pharmaceutical companies or CROs or industry. Yes? No? Some say no. So where do you come from? What is your background? Yeah? Yes? Ah, okay. All right. Okay. So, but basically mainly industry. So what Tony said is that we have to listen to patients. That's nice, but you need to put a bit of structure in how you listen, why do you listen, and what do you want? What do you expect from listening to patients? So what I would like to show you today. How is it working? Ah, okay, thank you. So if you are interested in the topic, you probably know most of the slides I will show you today, but I don't want to insist on the slides. I just want to tell you that basically we have quite a long experience of working with patients, and we started from a blank page. And basically we needed to build up this interaction with patients on trust and transparency. These are words you have listened to this morning already, but this is really important, trust and transparency. And in fact, it was a relatively easy journey for us because we identified the mutual benefit we could extract from working together, patient and regulators. And, of course, not everybody in the system was really convinced that we had to involve patients in the work we were supposed to do. But sometimes you just need a little bunch of convinced people to make things happen. So my first key message would be just do it. No, that's not my presentation. That's Natalie's presentation. You should have another one. So basically, I don't want to waste time, but basically my second slide was about the complexity of the regulatory process. And of course, when you involve patients in the regulatory process, you need to understand what kind of information you want to get from them, whether you need naive patients, whether you need an advocate who has already the knowledge about all this regulatory process, and whether there is a need of training and individual support for these patients. So these are also questions you need to answer before you start. So my third slide was also about the patient involvement along the life cycle to show you that basically we involve patients everywhere. We involve patients in the review of documents because we believe that, for example, package leaflets have to be reviewed by patients. We know that there is a user testing, but it's not enough because the text is changed between the user testing, which is performed by the pharmaceutical industry, and at the time of the approval when the text has been changed by all the reviews. We also involve patients as experts into the scientific advisory groups. In this case, they are really experts of their disease and the management of their disease. They are also involved in committees. You know that now most of the committees have patients as members, and they are supposed to represent the patient community in these committees. And then it will be difficult for me to discuss the next slide because it was a really important one. I have got a key, if you wish, to get a presentation.
Mailed it to them, and I think Natalie has
surprised
it on the membership.
Because
we'll get there.
We send it. Okay,
yeah,
never mind.
We'll get it.
What can I tell you in the meantime? Yeah, maybe I can speak to you about this aspect of patient representative and patient experts. So basically, what we have put in place is that we will ask patient representative, which means patient who have a better knowledge of the regulatory process and are able to advocate for other patients. We consult them on general issues, on transparency, on how to present a website, on these kind of things. And they are involved usually in non-confidential discussion. All we ask them to do is to be transparent on the funding of their organization. Now, when we go to experts, patients, we don't really ask them to have the whole knowledge of the regulatory process. It can be more naive, but they still need to have a really good understanding of the disease and its management. And we ask them to provide their own experience on the management of the disease. They have to sign a confidentiality undertaking. They have to fill in a declaration of interest. And we consult them on product-specific issues, confidential product-specific issues, so during the evaluation of the product. So let's go back to the presentation. So that was my talk about the complexity of the process and whether we want to involve naive patient or knowledgeable patient and the need to have a training and individual support for these patients who are involved. So you probably know this slide very well. That's when I explained that we, in the yellow bubbles, you have all the involvement of patient. And this is the life cycle of medicine from the perspective of the regulators. It's a bit different from the slide that Tony presented, because we look at it from the regulatory perspective, but basically it's the same, and you can see that patients are really involved at every single step of the regulatory process. So on this slide, we wanted to show you basically everything. So the patient engagement is at the center of the of this graph, and we do work with EMA, of course, but with the whole of the network. So when patients are involved at EMA, they have also this link with the whole network. And the purpose is to inform them, to consult them, and to make them participate to our activities. And we have different methodologies to do that. And we don't have a specific methodology for specific activities, but it's really à la carte. And so we have this, what we call the face-to-face meeting that we used, for example, when we had to review the referral on valproate, for example, where we identify the birth defect in children from mothers who had taken the valproate during their pregnancy, and that was very, very fruitful. We have also written consultation, for example, when we review, we ask them to review documents. They are, of course, involved in committee meetings, and we have recently finalized a pilot phase on involvement of patients in committee meetings, in CHMP meetings. We can use surveys and questionnaires, and this was already addressed this morning. And we have done with several patient organizations some studies, also with academics, universities, on patient preference elicitation. And we did a pilot on that 2 years ago with some myeloma and melanoma patients. And more recently, we did a more elaborated study with Myeloma UK, and it should be published very soon. And, of course, when we talk about patient engagement, we look at individual patients, we look at patient organization. We also need to listen to civil society representatives who sometimes have a view totally opposite to those of patients, but it always brings an additional component to the discussion, which is always very interesting. And, of course, we have the general public, and something which could have been added, but I didn't want to add it on this slide, is a public hearing that we are putting in place at the agency, because we don't believe public hearing is really consultation of patients. It's not a dialogue with patients. Something else, another type of thing that we promote now, it's not for us, but it's for more for industry to look at, is the integration of patient views in clinical studies, and particularly looking at the use of patient-reported outcome measures. In oncology studies, we have published a guideline to emphasize the values of this PRO data in the development of medicine, which is also something quite important. And this shows also the added value of getting patient views in the development. So with whom do we work? We work with patients through a network of eligible organizations. This was already mentioned this morning. We need to be careful about with what kind of people do we work with. And you can see the criteria that these organizations have to fulfill, and particularly transparency on their funding. And we do accept that a patient organization have industry funding, because otherwise most of them would not exist. But we have also recently opened a call for a pool of experts. So basically you go on the website and you can register as a patient expert on our website. This I already explained to you when I didn't have my slides, what is the difference between what we consider patient representative and patient experts. Now something which is always of interest for the companies is the handling of declaration of interest. And of course, you know this very well, and we need to balance the conflict of interest with the need to secure the best expertise. But you have to keep in mind, and that's something that some patients have difficulties to understand, is that no one can be both judge and jury. I think this is really the basics of this policy on conflict of interest. This is a summarized table on the policy and how it's applied. And as you can see, there are not many occurrences when patients cannot be involved. It's basically only when they are employee of pharmaceutical industry, which is quite understandable. When they have a role of consultant or are involved as a strategic advisors with industry, and again, not in all cases, and if they have financial interest with industry. So it, in a way, it's quite limited. And in other cases, we can ask patients to participate in different kind of activities. So as a conclusion, we have put in place quite unique model of patient engagement. Everything we have developed has been developed with patients. The criteria for patient organizations, the aspect of representative or expert, all of these things have been developed together with the patient organization and the representative of the civil society, talking about Health Action International, talking about BUC, the consumers, talking about IFA, the International Public Health Alliance. So all of them have participated to this development. I think now we don't have to demonstrate the need to take into account that the patient views are important in the regulatory work. Everybody is convinced about that. And the key message in terms of methodology is that there is no one-size-fits-all. There are different kinds of methodologies which can be used in different ways, in different perspectives. And we probably need further research on different methodologies. So I will stop here and I will welcome questions.
Thank you very much, Isabel. Thank you, Isabel. Thank you, Alastair. So we have time for a few questions. We'll make sure you have half an hour coffee break, no worries. But please fire away with any questions, comments, challenges you may have to any of the three of us, please. If you could just say your name, what you do, and then fire away.
Yes, hi, I'm Flaminia Macchia. I've been working for 15 years as a patient representative, and now I'm since a couple of years in industry. So I have a question about one of your last points, Isabel, on the fact that when a patient is in a strategic advisory role with an industry, then this patient cannot bring its expertise to the EMA. And I wanted to know whether, when you mention strategic advisory role, does this include also the so-called community advisory boards that are there for scientific advisory roles. So is the scientific information that patients can help building within a company with their expertise, with all what we talked about, that Eric told us about the insights, and it's very scientific, is this considered as a strategic advisory role that would then prevent the patient from working with the regulators? Thank you.
Okay, first of
all, I think he'll switch it on.
It's working? Yeah. So first of all, you need to consider that this is a current role if the patient is not anymore in this role, then they can be involved. So that's the first thing. Now, on this very precise question, I don't know. I don't know if Natalie can answer this one. Yeah? You will mention it this in the session afterwards. So we will come back on this one later on.
Yeah, because what I mean is that we have seen how absolutely important and fundamental, and I think, well, it would be maybe politically incorrect, but also just wrong to say the opposite, what the importance of patient expertise is within the drug development process as such. So if then they have to pay for what they give, then there is something that is wrong. We have to rethink the system.
It's not a matter of paying for what they give. Yes. It's a matter of you cannot be judge and party at the same time.
But who is not? This is my question. Like, for instance, when we talk about the healthcare professionals, how come that the healthcare professionals can get a fair market value, and this is not a problem, they can be paid, and the patients is more difficult to do the same? You see, sometimes it feels like there are really two...
No. Okay. I'm sorry, but in terms of expert, we consider that patient, healthcare professional, academics, whoever is considered an expert is treated in the same way. We don't make any difference between patient and healthcare professional, scientist, academics. They are experts. They all follow the same policy, and we reimburse them on the same basis. They are treated in exactly the same way.
Hello, I'm Richard Wind. I'm actually a patient. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 7.5 years ago. Just a quick comment on Alistair's point. The operation you mentioned, the clinical trial with the injection into the brain, I actually had that operation just over a year ago at Addenbrooke's Hospital in the UK. It's a project that's funded by the European Union and is still ongoing at the moment. I just want to make a couple of points. I find this very interesting, coming from the background I do as a patient, having found I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease a number of years ago. No knowledge of the condition. Everything I've found out since then is relatively new to me. Some interesting points, I thought, from the discussion this morning. What is a patient representative? It seems, have you got representatives who work across different organisations, different diseases, different charities and so on? Or is it someone who's working just for one condition? It seems to me that you need the expertise in getting things through the regulatory process rather than needing knowledge about the condition itself. Another question following on from that again. It seems that it's almost, I'm not sure how it would progress. If someone becomes an expert, a real expert in a particular area, then they're deemed as an expert tourist or whatever, and then perhaps it's more difficult for them to be involved after that. Is there an issue there? And a particular point on representation as well. I work quite closely with Parkinson's UK. We have regular meetings with members. And at one meeting I went to, we gave a little exercise for people to do, which was putting five counters, allocating where the resources should be spent, because Parkinson's UK also provides support services. And there were people who were putting all the counters on non-research-based activities. Other people are putting all their counters on research to find a cure for the condition. So I think it's very difficult to come to a representative view of what patients want when there's this sort of wide divide. Is it support now, in the here and now, or is it research in order to find a cure? So I've been through, I don't know, a couple of things there, but you can comment on some of those points.
Thank you very much. Alistair, why don't you start?
Yes, sure, thanks. Thanks for that comment. I'm delighted the work has progressed from that initial trial. It just goes to show that, in a sense, that with continued engagement with the patient community, maybe things that initially might have been put to one side as being too unsafe or not delivering sufficient benefit can often be brought back from retirement and given a new lease of life. So let's hope that trial is successful and produces an intervention. I think you're absolutely right. You need to have both insights into the condition from the perspective of those who live with it, but also, excuse me, insights into the regulatory process and how to present the arguments that will persuade either the regulators at the European Medicines Agency or the panels in HTA agencies like NICE or Scottish Medicines Consortium or whatever. I remember some years ago I was at a conference in Berlin where one particular patient representative was devastated when a regulator, an HTA person rather, told her that suffering is not enough. You know, you have to present the arguments in ways that the regulators, that the HTA bodies can respond to and understand in terms that relate to the task they're trying to achieve. So I think you need both is the answer.
And, you know, in many ways, one size doesn't fit all, right? Sometimes it's really an individual view we need, and sometimes, like Alastair says, some specific knowledge, and Jan will be on stage later. I mean, what we've done with your party is just one example where patients have learned so much, and I'm so grateful that they've gone through that journey.
Just to pick up on Isabel's comment about not being judge and jury in your own case, I mean, obviously, that is correct. You can, you shouldn't be in a position where that conflict of interest can arise. But practically, particularly in areas of very rare conditions, it can be difficult to find clinicians, experts, even patient representatives, who, you know, because the population is so small, have not been as either participating in the trial or as a clinician recruiting or whatever. So I think, you know, there needs to be a balance. If you do, you know, the sort of large-scale trials, you can avoid that because there are plenty of experts. But in small developments for very rare conditions, there needs to be a degree of flexibility. Otherwise, you end up running the risk of only being able to talk to people who have not been involved and therefore may not be at the front edge of knowledge.
No, we totally agree with what you say, and that's why I mentioned on my slide that we need to balance that with the need to get the best expertise, and of course we will. And we have some mechanism to involve these people who have been involved on both sides. So, I mean, it's taken on board, and we do agree with this.
So big thank you to the panel. I suggest we take a 30-minute break, unless you want to instruct us differently. My proposal is that we reconvene at 11 o'clock, and thank you again.
Yes, I'd like to thank Isabel and Alistair and Eric and Tony. I thought actually before we break, if we could take just 2 minutes to introduce ourselves to one another at the table and to discuss why are we here. And so why don't we do that? Take 2 minutes, introduce yourselves to each other at the table. We'll take a break. I do want to tell everybody that if you are a patient or you represent a patient in the audience, we have badges that clearly identify you, which we know where your perspective is coming from. And if you'd like to join the Ask the Patients program, it's a program where you're identified as a patient and it allows people to ask you, what was your experience like in a clinical trial and what advice do you have? 1 o'clock today, we have a fire drill, I'm sorry to say, but luckily it's during lunch. It should only last a minute. And if it doesn't, I will get really uptight about it and have a word with the hotel. So with that, take 2 minutes. Please introduce yourselves to your neighbor and then we'll take a break. Thank you.